Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step 3, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at chumbacasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning into Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 18, Episode 3. This week, Bob had a wonderful conversation with attorney and YouTuber Andrea Burkhart about the Delphi trial. We are sans Janet today, but Bob and I are here to discuss all of it. But before we get into that, do we have any housekeeping?
I don't think so, other than just to give you a plan for the next couple episodes. So our patrons know, I think I'm going to mention it in the episode, but patrons that were joining live when we chatted with Andrea, that was actually like an hour and a half conversation. But the way it was broken up, we covered the trial for the first 45 minutes or 40 minutes for this week. And then we decided to break it and then continue on another half where we talk about all the post-conviction stuff. So that episode is what's going to come out this Sunday. Again, if you're a patron, you have the opportunity. You've already seen that. The video is still up for you guys to go watch if you'd like.
Patrons, I'm very jealous because I have to wait until this week.
Yeah,
and we could
give Zach a link, but we're just not going to.
It just doesn't happen.
We try to keep you in line with everybody else.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then after that, during that conversation in the chat, Michael Osbrook, who's also, who actually is like connected to the case and has helped work on the case, was in the chat talking about some of the new evidence and things that have come forward since the trial has aired. And that is going to be the trial happened. So we got Andrea Burkhart coming back to talk post-conviction this week. And then the following week, Michael Osbrook is back to talk about all of the new evidence and kind of the inside baseball as to what's going on that. So we're all Delphi for the next 2 weeks. So we get completely caught up.
I love it. I love talking about Delphi. I mean, that's probably not the right sentiment to say, because it's not that it's a great thing, but it just is a case that absolutely fascinates me.
You know, I'm so glad that Andrea was able to come on. And first of all, I've exchanged social media back and forth with her, but I've never actually talked to her. So that was great having the opportunity to speak to her. And of course, I've consumed a ton of her content. But it was also really nice to have a different perspective. I mean, you know, y'all know I love Bob Mata, and I think his analysis is spot on. But also, I don't want just one side's analysis.
Right.
So, you know, Andrea being there and also as another attorney being in the room for the trial was really eye-opening for me to see, you know, how does another attorney look at the case from their own perspective? And then, you know, and I even, if you remember back when we covered Delphi during the trial, I even tried to get the host from the Murder Sheets to come on, and they were apparently not interested because I know they are convinced that Richard Allen is guilty. So I wanted to hear all the different perspectives, but did you consume much of her content during the trial?
I did not. Unfortunately, I did not. A lot of the material that I consumed was Mata's because there was so much of it. You know, I mean,
yeah.
I don't want to say there was so much of it, but Mata's live streams.
There was a lot of it. Yeah.
Well, Mata's live streams were hours long.
Right.
So by the time I listened to one, I had to go to bed or had, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was just hard to try to consume from other content creators. I wish I could have done it a little more, but you know, since then I've tried to catch up a little bit on different content creators and where they stand and,
yeah,
and their ideas. And I really enjoyed listening to Andrea Burkhart talk about this today or this week.
Yeah, me too. And I was kind of in the same boat. I definitely consumed more of Bob's content than I did Andrea's, but I tried to get some of both. And that was just it, you know, because they both did multi-hour streams every single day.
Right.
After, and I thought it was really cool that there were listeners that were going in and holding her spot in line for her.
That is really cool, actually.
Yes. Yeah.
True crime listeners, I'm going to put a blanket statement out there, and I don't care if you are pro or con either way, but true crime listeners really are some amazing people.
Yeah.
You know, whether you think Richard Allen is guilty, whether you think he's innocent during this, doesn't matter. Like, they are truly amazing people that really put forth a lot of effort to help out the best they can. And I think it's really cool.
Yeah, it is. But I just want to point out that from my perspective, some of them are assholes. I mean, not all of them are great. You're nicer than me. Some of them are real dicks. You know what I mean?
I like people. I like to see the best in people. Also, probably one of my biggest downfalls is I like to see the best in people.
Yeah.
It really kicks me in the ass sometimes.
I got 11 years of them beating me up. So
that's true.
Yeah.
That's true. No, it was fun. It was a good conversation. It was really interesting to hear the way she processed some of it, coming from a different state. And I guess I didn't realize where she was coming from as far as being an attorney. So coming from a different state, seeing the laws in a different way.
Yeah.
Seeing how Indiana processes things, especially now that we just went through some of that with the Bynum case, understanding how difficult some of that is. That was really interesting to hear her discuss that. And some of the things like the learned witness, that's fucking bonkers to me.
Did you, I feel like I'm already getting very unserious with some of this stuff, but all I could think about when I heard it, because that's what I found most interesting. You know, a lot of the information about the trial we heard is, you know, it was the same thing we heard from Mata and the same things we were reading about back then. There wasn't any like big new real revelations there. But like learning about how some of the laws work was interesting to me. And that was one of them. I guess maybe we talked about it before and I didn't remember it. But man, every time I heard learned witness, all I always think about was Step Brothers.
Yeah.
That this is a house of learned doctors. Right. Like, what a crazy law.
Yeah, it's wild.
You know, and you haven't been so much into this. But for me, like some of the cases that I've been involved with for the year, you go back to Adnan's case. You know, we have things like Fry hearings. And there's such a standard. And so many like motions and arguments that are made all the time for someone to be able to testify or for evidence to be able to come in. And I didn't get a chance to get this out in our conversation, but it was like all I was thinking of is all the transcripts I've read and how quickly someone will get shut down by an objection all the time. And I've read enough of them that I know it's coming, which is when someone is trying to give an opinion that is not in their field of expertise, someone is going to object always.
Yeah.
And it's going to be sustained always. You know, somebody might be, you know, a cop might be on the stand and they'll be like, well, why do you think they did that? But like, objection, he's not a psychologist. You know, there's always like, if you are not confirmed to be an expert in that field, you can smell it coming when you're reading a transcript. Like, no. And in this case, it was like everybody, I mean, and we didn't even talk about some of the officers that testified that it was Richard Allen's voice in the tape, you know, things like that. Like those are the types of things in every other trial I've ever read where if someone other than like, I don't even know what it would be, a sound engineer, audiologist, whatever that expert level is, were to say that's definitely his voice, that would be an immediate objection. You do not have the expertise to say that. You cannot do it. The only time you may get away with it, if it's somebody that knows him, like you're, air quote expertise might be that, you know, like if you were on trial and there was some recording that I could testify to, like I know Zach, I've heard Zach, and even then it would be limited. I could say to me that sounds like him.
In your opinion, it sounds like
all that stuff that came out in the trial it's
wild.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely wild. And the whole idea like that they could just come in and say that they thought he was faking mental illness or how, I mean, just to be prison guards to do that is
another, yeah, exact perfect example. Yeah, when someone who is not a doctor or a psychologist to talk about someone's mental state, Like that would never be allowed. And I don't know. I didn't ask about. I think it's pretty unique to Indiana. I don't know if there's other states that allow that, but I've just never. You know, I haven't read trial transcripts from every state, but I've read them from a lot of them, and I've just never seen anything like that before.
So the you put the prison guard on the stand. As long as there's not a direct question, would they be able to slide something like that in?
No.
Not at all. Even if they did, they would just object to it.
Yeah. So the way that would go is, so say the question that the prosecutor asked was, you know, what did you witness mm-hmm. with Richard Allen in his jail cell that day? Right. That's you're a direct witness to it. You can testify to that. So he starts testifying and in his answer, he's like, I witnessed him. He was banging his head on the wall. He was doing this. He was doing that. Like that would all be allowed. But then if he just continued on without being prompted, continued on and say, he was clearly, he clearly wasn't having a psychological break. He was faking what he was doing. The second he started saying that, the defense attorney would say, objection, Your Honor, he is not qualified to assess someone's mental state. He's not a qualified expert in that field. And the judge would generally sustain it until to strike that from the record and instruct the jury to ignore that, which is always like that whole, I always hate those objections where there's like, I'd like you to put the toothpaste back in the tube, please.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as though the jury's not going to remember
that you said it.
What they heard.
I'll tell you what really upsets me about this entire case. I do not know. I truthfully do not know where I stand. I do not know if I believe Richard Allen is innocent. I do not know that if I believe Richard Allen is guilty. What I do know is seeing what I saw, what we are informed of that was at trial. I don't think they should have convicted him
mm-hmm.
based on that. The biggest problem I see, though, and now knowing this, working with Indiana last season, is how hard it's going to be to get rid of this. Like, I know that they were trying to just essentially take Richard Allen because he's who came on the radar and lock him up and throw away the key because it appeased the masses. And now that it's done, it's going to be so incredibly hard to undo because of what Indiana puts forth.
Yeah. And as far as the motivation for doing it, you know, I can only speculate, but it's like Andrea pointed out, just so happened to be that there was a contested election coming up right then.
Because mm-hmm.
it seemed like that was I mentioned, like, the weirdest thing for me about this case is the trigger. Like, what triggered this? With everything else they had, all the other leads they blew, and it was, again, as I said in the episode, what baffles me, has always baffled me about this case, is the inconsistency, you know, where it's, as far as the doggedness of the investigation, right? It's just, you know, it's like, oh, they got great leads. They blow them off. They start investigating. They just don't necessarily clear somebody as a suspect, but they just stop looking at them as a suspect. They're not doing, they're not releasing stuff to the public. They're not, like, they're just all the different things they're doing. And then all of a sudden, they're just like, we're 100% going to go after this guy. It wasn't consistent with the previous work they did. Didn't make sense to me. And that was, you know, so I would speculate that it's probably, you know, I would have to think that it does have something to do with the fact that election was coming up. But to your point, then, yeah, innocent or guilty, if he is innocent, undoing this is going to be very difficult the way Indiana law works. And that's part of what we'll be discussing in this week's episode that's coming out on Sunday. It's right. And as far as like a stand on the case, like I have a more firmer stance on it. And it's not just that I don't know if he's innocent or guilty or that I don't think he should be convicted. I won't go so far as to say he's innocent, because I don't know. But what I will go so far as to say is he's not guilty to me. Like, it wouldn't be just like, I wouldn't be just acquitting him because there's some legal standards. Not, like, from a factual innocence standpoint and factual guilt standpoint to me, the state did nothing to me to prove that he's guilty. They didn't do anything to me to suggest that he's guilty.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about the bullet casing, that means nothing to me. And that's not some of the, again, this is one of the, I have no dog in this fight. As a matter of fact, if I had a dog in the fight, is that I wanted him to be guilty.
Yeah.
That, you know, that I just want this to be over. I
know that, you know, I've changed my opinion on different parts of this case, but I think anybody that's a longtime listener, it was in our off season. Maybe season 13, we had an off season where we were doing a few different things, is when this all really broke.
Mm-hmm.
And to, for lack of a better term, you and I were excited that they caught somebody.
Yeah.
Like, so I know that you're on that side of the fence. You were truly on that side of the fence to begin with. You're like, I want it to be this guy.
Well, and you heard the private conversations we had with Bob Mata.
Yeah.
You know, I was the only one in the room that was just like, I don't buy it. It's bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
No, like, and what I kept saying, if not him, who?
Yeah.
But we didn't have a lot of the information then. But I was just like, yeah, get the case is shaky, but come on.
Yeah.
So this is not like I went into this trying to prove that Richard Allen was innocent. It's just when it came out, you know, like I said, you've got the bullet evidence like that. And I'm not exaggerating. That means nothing to me.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you can do all that to come up with maybe it's consistent, but it's, by the way, it's also consistent with two other guns we tested, and it could be consistent with any, you know, with like,
yeah,
that means nothing to me. Absolutely nothing to me. The fact that you don't have a single witness that can say, I saw him on the bridge at the time that, you know, we have the witnesses with the, you know, the girls that said they saw a guy who matched the picture of bridge guy,
mm-hmm.
but never said, it looks like that man sitting right there. They never said it looked like Richard Allen.
Five years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Do you want to clear the number of girls up really quick, too? I know that was a kind of a concern that kind of came up in the Andrea Burkhart interview.
Yeah. So some people actually listening to the episode, you probably didn't know it came up. I don't think it was said.
Okay.
So, but in the live chat, when Michael Osberg was in the live chat, I think Andrea said that Richard Allen said he saw four young girls and that the state put up three girls who said they were a group of three girls. And that's what Andrea had said. Michael Osberg was in the chat correcting that and said it's actually the other way around. We were flowing in the conversation, so I let it go to fact check that later. But this, to be clear, for those that didn't really follow the case, this is what happened. So when Richard Allen was interviewed with police, he said, now the time he said he was there was, I think, a couple hours before the murders happened before they were abducted. He said, and they asked him who he saw there, and he said he saw a group of three young girls. There was three girls that had passed him that he saw. Abby and Libby weren't with them. Mm-hmm. It was just these three girls he saw. At trial, the state puts on a group of four girls who say they were there together. And you had looked up, but it was like...
It was a girl, her friend, and two sisters is what it's labeled as.
Yeah. And so it was a group of four girls. Those are the four girls that testified that they saw a man on the bridge around the time the girls were killed that matched or looked similar to
Bridge Guy.
So then the state at trial conflated those together and said, look, Richard Allen said he saw this group of girls. Here's the group of girls. And they're saying the guy they saw looked like Bridge Guy. And so they like did this weird connecting of dots when in reality, they don't mesh at all.
Mm.
You know, so you have Richard Allen said he saw a group of three girls. I'm making up times, but say around 12:30. And then a group of four girls that was there at 2:30 said they saw a guy who looked like Bridge Guy. And then the state says that's them saying they saw Richard Allen, and Richard Allen confirming it by saying he saw this group.
Yeah.
So the point Andrea was making remains. It's just the three and four were backwards. I think she said Richard Allen said four. They said three is the other way right. around. But it's also one of the things that's, as I mentioned, for me, when I'm looking at same way I look at any of these wrongful conviction cases or potential wrongful conviction cases that are sent to us, when I'm screening it, I look at the state's case. And if the state's case can convince me, then I'm not taking the case. You know, if I look closer and it gets stronger, I'm out.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, when you look a little closer, it's like, okay, that's the state's theory. But let me, what did they actually say? The whole time, I mean, I guarantee you, this is an assumption, but I can almost assume that they were probably shown a photo lineup of Richard Allen, but they couldn't give any facial features. None of that was in their testimony. They didn't do any of that, but they weren't able to identify him there. Then when they're on the stand, and again, this is what drives me crazy, that our system is built around the idea that the state is the underdog because they have the burden of proof. And so they get all the advantages, right? They get to talk first. They get to talk last. They get to present their case first. The defense goes second. They get the final rebuttal in the closing arguments. They get all that, all because they're the underdog, because they're innocent until proven guilty. We know in practical terms, that's generally not the case. Most jurors don't look at it that way, even though that's the law. But they get all these advantages already, and then they're able to position themselves like they did here. They knew, the state knew, if they asked those girls, is the man you saw on the bridge sitting in this courtroom today, that those girls were not going to identify Richard Allen.
Mm-hmm.
I promise you they knew that from pre-interviews, from trial prep, because if they thought there was even a chance they would have asked. So they knew if they asked them, is that the guy you saw, that they were not going to identify Richard Allen. So the way they got around it was just not to ask. And then you think, well, that's easy enough because the defense can come up and say, is the man you saw sitting in this courtroom today? But the problem is the defense is no defense attorney is going to do that because they don't know what they're going to say. So that could be one of the biggest backfire. Could you imagine in that trial, if the state did their direct examination of those girls, they sit down, no real damage is done unless the jury's connecting the dots that they're going to connect in the closing arguments. Then the defense gets up and says, who is the man you saw on the bridge? Do you see him in this courtroom? If they said, yeah, it was him right there, that's it.
Yeah.
It's over with. So they're never going to risk that. And the state also knew they wouldn't risk that. So they're able to manipulate the amount of evidence the jury gets because they know what the defense is going to be too afraid to ask. Now, I guess going back to my list, so when I'm looking at what did they do to not just prove to me, but what did they do to even indicate to me that probably, you know, because there are those situations where you're like, I couldn't have convicted, but I think factually they're probably guilty.
Mm-hmm.
That's a thing for me. This wasn't the case with that because the bullet means nothing. The witness testimony means nothing. And then we have the confessions, and the confessions mean nothing. And that is that anybody's listening for any length of time knows that is 100% consistent with any time I've analyzed any kind of incriminating statement. Is I go through the same process. Is it actually a confession or is it just some kind of weird utterance?
Mm-hmm.
Most of these were weird utterances. I think I did it. What if I did it? Would you still love me if I did it? Like that's testing why that's not a confession. Then if they actually do give a confession that has a narrative with a beginning, middle, and end, which we eventually get sort of secondhand from Dr. Walla, it's factually inaccurate. You know, it's like there's items thrown in. You know, the place he said he found the bullet is not where he dropped the bullet. It's not where the bullet was found. He couldn't explain, or she couldn't explain, how the bullet got out of the gun. Just it did something and the bullet came out.
Mm-hmm.
The timing of when the van went by, that's not right. Like none of it is accurate. So that's what I'm looking at. So, okay, in this narrative, is the narrative supported by the evidence? The next step would be, is there any way he could have known that anyway? So you already lose me there,
mm-hmm.
that it's not factually accurate or supported by the evidence. But even if it was, then my next step would be, okay, is this guilty knowledge or could this come from another source? And in this case, you have the fact that he had access to all his files that he was spreading out all over his floor and able to read all the files. He had all these conversations with Dr. Walla, who then we find out is like, in chat groups, going out to the bridge, so that there's so many different ways for that evidence. Now, if the if what he said was factually accurate and he was in a healthy state of mind and the confession had no indications of coercion, I would then put that in the category of, well, that makes me question it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that she knew that takes some of the credibility away. I wouldn't say it takes all the credibility away from the confession. But in this case, it's factually inaccurate. She has all this knowledge. She's breaking the law in a lot of the things that she's doing if I remember correctly, she lied. Mm-hmm. To get, you know, to be able to continue working with him. She lied to the supervisors at the prison. Like, there's all these things. So she already doesn't have credibility. And so putting all that together, the confessions mean nothing to me.
Yeah.
So what am I left with? What indicates he's guilty? Nothing. Now, as they say, absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. I won't go so far as to say that 100% I'm convinced he's innocent. What I will go as far as say is, and I have said many times before, is there's nothing that I've seen presented to indicate or persuade me that Richard Allen killed Abby and Libby.
And I've actually, you know, I didn't think anything about confessions. You know, I thought if it was a confession, it was a confession. And you've really taught me a lot. Even going back to, like, this is what makes me think about it right now, is going back to last season in the Gerald Matthews confession, which is a confession that would have helped your case,
right,
which you're the one that tore it apart.
Right.
Even though this would have helped the case.
Yeah.
You're the one going, yeah, but this isn't accurate.
When you were saying earlier how great all the true crime people are.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I mean. Like, there are always those times for me, because I have to, I enjoy interacting with most people, but I interact with so many people on social in doing this, that there are just the people that are out there that if I present an argument that they disagree with, and that's not everybody, but these people are out there. It's always the same old tired argument.
Mm-hmm.
You're biased, you're cherry picking, you're doing, but like you said, like the best thing, if I was just everybody's innocent, when I'm doing the Bynum case, I would have tried to sell you guys the Matthews confession.
Right.
Instead, you heard, like you said, even though it would have been helpful, I pointed out every flaw that I saw in it and everything that I see wrong with it. Because that's just what was presented to me. That was my analysis.
Yeah. And Mandy in our chat has a point about that. She said, I'm surprised how entrenched each side is on his guilt. You would think with true crime that has such a major component of wrongful convictions, but people just dig in so deep.
Yeah. And there's definitely some, I mean, that goes way well beyond true crime. I mean, it's kind of with everything anymore, it seems like. And that's me being an old fuddy-duddy and saying, you know, that I really think social media is just destroying the fabric of everything. The algorithmic manipulation that happens in social media, I think I want to believe that is a huge contributing factor to why that happens, because I think that people form their opinion and everybody's entitled to their opinion. Like, I'm not sitting here telling you that I'm right about this. I'm just telling you my opinion about it. People will formulate their opinion. And then they get on social media and start sharing their opinion. And these algorithms literally surround you with people that are agreeing with you. And they show you and not only do they show you other comments and posts from people that are agreeing with you, the algorithms are literally set to pick out the most, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, just the ones that are going to get everybody the most fired up. If it's getting people pissed off, that's the one they want to show you. And I just think that it helps him. I think it takes away people's objectivity if you're not careful. Mm-hmm. I think it's real easy to take away the ability to hear somebody, you know, and that's if you're stuck in a bubble of people where everybody agrees with you, then when you see what appears to be an outlier, it's easy to feel like I'm right because everyone around me says I'm right and you're crazy, when the other side thinks the exact same thing. They're surrounded by people that are all validating their views. And it seems like the whole world agrees with them. So then the person who disagrees is now an outlier and they're crazy. And I feel like that's, I don't know why I got on this bandwagon, because it just drives me insane. And that's what, like, people get upset that I'm not on social media. And that's why, because I can feel it warping my own brain. So I just stay away from it.
Yeah. And I think this really is a good spot to lead us into our first question, which comes from longtime listener Michelle. It says, I think it's important you have someone from the criminal justice system, perhaps unfamiliar with the Delphi trial, explain the difference between administrative segregation, what Allen was in, and solitary confinement, something very different where a person cannot meet with a counselor, have a tablet to contact their family, etc. Why do you persist with the narrative on your podcast that he was held in solitary confinement, as some have said unconstitutionally. He was in fact held in administrative segregation to keep him safe from other prisoners. Continuing to propagate this mischaracterization gives your arguments about his innocence less credibility. The truth doesn't need exaggeration or embellishment. Do you plan to correct this on the record?
It's kind of right along the lines of what I was talking about. Mischaracterization is doing a lot of work in that statement, I think. So let's break it down. I don't know. I guess I didn't know that it was. I mean, I knew that he was put into the situation he was in supposedly to protect him. If that was called administrative segregation and not solitary confinement, then there's the correction. As far as mischaracterizing it, well, let me back up even further. Using that to propagate his innocence, as if you're not listening to me if you think that's what I'm doing. If you think that I'm propagating his innocence at all, you're not listening. As what I just explained here a few minutes ago is the same thing that I've explained back when we were covering Delphi in depth last year, is I'm looking at every single element of the state's case and seeing if any of it holds water, and none of it does for me. If it does for you, great. That's fine. I'm not here to argue with you about it. I'm only giving you my opinion about it. But to say it's mischaracterized, okay, so let's say, I'm not even going to say, I'll assume you're right, and it's administrative segregation and not solitary confinement. The effect, the practical effect of the situation he was put in was the same. Michelle said it herself. If you're in administrative segregation, you get access to your family and a tablet and a counselor. People in solitary confinement don't. And I think further in her message, she was talking about, like, you know, the good examples. If you look at interviews with Damien Eccles, I know what it is. I'm friends with Damien Eccles. I've had intimate conversations with him about what that experience was like. The problem here is your argument would stand if he did have access to his tablet and did have access to visitors. But the fact is, as I understand it, that wasn't the case. Wasn't it a whole thing that is, because it was brought out in trial on the stand, that his tablet was broken. He couldn't get a new one. They wouldn't give him a new tablet. And he wasn't given it to it until, till right after he confessed.
I do believe so.
Yeah. And he wasn't allowed to see his wife or talk to his wife for, I don't remember, it's been too long, how many days or weeks it was that he was. So he may not have been in solitary confinement, but he wasn't given access to visitors. He wasn't given access to a tablet to be able to talk to anybody. He was, in all practical terms, in solitary confinement. You can call it whatever you want. But to say it's mischaracterized, it's the same fucking thing. The situation that he was in.
Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pre-game podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I may be wrong if I may be misremembering this, but I feel like the first quote-unquote confession to his wife came after that long break where he was not allowed to talk to his wife. There was a long time period
right.
where he was not allowed to speak with her on the phone.
Right.
And then magically, the first time he talks to her on the phone is when that first confession comes. And I could be misremembering that.
There's somewhere around that time frame.
Yeah.
But as far as like the conditions he was put in, he was isolated from other prisoners. He was isolated from his entire support network, both in person and on the phone and on the iPad. He wasn't able to talk to anybody. He was in the same type of conditions while he was in administrative segregation as solitary confinement. So if the term, and again, I will concede the terminology, and I don't remember saying that, but the terminology that I use saying solitary confinement is incorrect. Then you also mentioned, well, people in solitary confinement don't have access to a counselor. Well, that's true, but what was the counselor he had access to? The counselor that he had access to was someone obsessed with this case that was researching it online, that was going out to the site to be able to get more information about it, was lying to the bosses at the prison so that she could have access to him, who elicited a fucking confession out of him. Well, it literally sat in the room with him while he made phone calls to his wife to confess. That's the counselor that he was given access to. So if the argument is, I used the wrong term, I apologize, the correct term is administrative segregation. If the argument is that I'm over-exaggerating the conditions he was in that led to the confession, I staunchly disagree with that. You can call it whatever the hell you want to. The conditions he was in, I think this would be different if we just in a vacuum said, or if I just in a vacuum said, well, they put him in solitary confinement and then he confessed. That's not what happened. We have gone into, and again, much more in depth back when we first covered this, we have gone in incredible depth and detail, not just from Mata, who was in the courtroom, not just from Burkhart that was in the courtroom, but from every news source that was in the courtroom and heard every bit of testimony and every report that was published back then during the trial, and gave you an exact detailed account of the conditions he was in. That is very different than us just saying he was in solitary confinement, like I'm trying to fucking trick you. That's not at all what happened. That's not what's going on here. And the last thing I'll say is to suggest that I'm exaggerating that in order to try to bolster an argument of innocence is complete and absolute nonsense. I've never even tried to bolster an argument for innocence. In fact, the opposite is true. What I've looked at is tried to look and see if the state's case holds up. If it's strong enough evidence to convince me. If it's strong enough evidence to convince you, great. I'm never, ever here to argue with somebody about opinions. But I'm sure as hell not, I don't have a dog in the fight. As I said, If I had a bias going into the case, it was that I wanted him to be guilty. I argued with Bob Mata himself about him being guilty up until I finally saw all the evidence at trial. And that's when I was finally like, oh, my God, like, that's the fucking case against him.
Yeah,
that's how strong that's what the state has. After all this time, that's what they brought this guy to trial with. For me, that's just not enough to convince me. If it's enough to convince you, great. Perhaps you're much smarter than I am. And I'm not even being facetious. Very likely true. I don't know anything about your background or anybody's background, but that's where I land, and that's why I land there.
Well, moving forward, this kind of takes us into Lori's point. She's got a couple points, but right into her first point. It says, I would have thought if all they wanted to do was back into a person for this, they would have gone after RL, Ron Logan. I really was thinking that it all made sense when they found the misfiled interview where RA, Richard Allen, said he had been there at the time in question. He was the missing link. He had no good explanation about his phone either. Was he lying about checking stocks? A car just like his was seen there. He has no true alibi, but admitted he was there. And it also says, I hold no weight to the confessions, by the way.
Yeah, I don't know. That these are things that I sure wish the state would have pinned down. This is why I've not said he's innocent. I've said they didn't prove him guilty, because everything you just described there is like there are circumstantial situations where you can try and connect some dots to it. None of those things. He was there. Well, people said they saw him there. When did they say they saw him there? And how does that line up with him? When did they say they saw his car there? How does that compare to the other evidence of other suspects? You mentioned Ron Logan. I don't know. I've said from a year ago when we were talking about this, my kind of focus of Ron Logan as a suspect is based off of the evidence that's been produced publicly in the file that sure as hell makes him look like a better suspect to me than Richard Allen. Why they didn't go after him, I have no idea, and that's the problem. If there was a document that said, we checked this, alibi checked out, he's clear, great, he's clear. But that document doesn't exist. And so, like you said, like Richard Allen doesn't have a verifiable alibi. That also doesn't mean that he was there killing those girls.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't have a verifiable alibi anymore. You talked about phone. What about Ron Logan's phone circling down by the crime? You know, there's all these different things that are weighing where it's like, it's evidence to suggest that maybe he could be involved, which is what holds me back from saying he's absolutely innocent.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's evidence that he could, but that's not the standard. That's not the standard for court, and that's not the standard for me when I'm trying to determine, in my own opinion, of what is factual guilt. The standard isn't, show me evidence that he could have done it. The standard is, show me evidence that he did do it.
Her second point, which I jumped the gun on a little bit, it goes back to the girls we were talking about earlier. But Lori says, if R.A., Richard Allen, really saw four brunette girls with long hair, why haven't they come forward? It seems more logical to me that the three girls were really there and that the four girls were made up by R.A., Richard Allen. Or he somehow felt that he needed to change the truth a little to protect himself in some way. Not an expert on this case, so this is just my take as a super lay person hearing this episode. Apologies to all who know this case backward and forward.
Yeah, and just to be clear, she flip-flopped it like Andrea did. Yes. So that's the other way around. The answer is, I don't know. One explanation is, generally speaking, a lot of people don't take note of every little person they see, especially if there's three. He says he passed three teenage girls. They didn't interact. They didn't talk. They just walked past each other. If the three girls are just sitting there talking to each other, looking at their phones, walking past, don't notice a guy that walks by them, perhaps they didn't come forward because they didn't even notice that it happened. Or could be also both. And there's always a possibility that Richard Allen was telling the truth. And he saw those three girls at 12:30 in the afternoon. And then they put out, anybody who saw anybody on the bridge at between 2 and 2:30, come forward. And they didn't come forward because they didn't see anybody in the bridge between 2 and 2:30. Because they were there 2 hours before that. Like, we don't know. I wish I had an answer for you. I don't. But, you know, there's all these different possibilities. I'm not willing to, and never am willing to, jump to the conclusion, well, then it just must mean that even though he said he saw three and there was four other ones, those four can't identify him as being the person or haven't identified him as being the person. Let's just assume that it was the same group. I just don't operate like that.
So Josh in the chat, who is an actual local to this case, says, I find it very concerning that Ron Logan had an alibi for the exact time he needed. And they said there was absolutely no time frame given when the girls went missing.
Well, I find it more concerning that he had an alibi for the exact time he needed when the girls were killed. I find it even more concerning that we then later find out that prior to them even, I believe, them even finding out the girls were dead, that he contacted his, was it his cousin?
I don't, he did contact somebody, I can't remember who
somebody
it was.
Who admitted he called him and told him to make up the alibi. So not only was it just the perfect alibi, but it was faked. It was intentionally faked for the exact time when the murders happened. Like that. Now, if you told me that about Richard Allen, because again, I don't care who it is. I want the person who killed Abby and Libby brought to justice. If you told me that about Richard Allen, be like, that has my interest. That means something to me.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And again, I don't necessarily think that just because he has that alibi at that time means he did it, but it's concerning and he should be looked into way more than he was.
Yeah. And as Josh said, that's exactly what he's talking about because no one knew what was going on in the area.
Yeah. So that leads us to our last question, which comes from Teresa. Is there any way to compel the state to test any of the DNA found at the scene?
That is a lawyer question, and lucky for you, that is one of the things on our docket for when Michael Osbert comes back on. When I was talking about that with Andrea, he was in the chat and was mentioning, it looked like he was saying that they're not able to test the DNA because of some statute or some reason the way things work in Indiana. And that was one of the reasons why as soon as the stream was over, I text Michael and said, hey, can you come on and explain that to us? So that won't be this Sunday. That'll be next Sunday. I'm going to have Michael back on, and he will have a great answer for that question for you, I'm sure, and he'll be able to explain it all, along with all the other evidence that we didn't get into with Andrea while she was here. But what we have coming up this Sunday is Andrea's back for part two of that interview, where we're talking about post-conviction stuff. And our focus there is on what's going on with the appeals, what avenues are available, what errors were brought up in the appeals. And at the end of the conversation, which I think was my favorite part of the conversation, I asked Andrea, because it's very hard to predict what a judge would do. I asked her, she's got 20 years experience as an attorney. She was there at the trial. She's read the briefs. I asked her, if you were a judge and your job was to rule on this case, how would you rule and why? And her answer will just knock your socks off. That's all coming up this Sunday, and we'll talk about it in next week's follow-up. Bye, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been
Truth and Justice.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk, still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.